This season at the First Time Podcast, we are returning to our first time roots. We hear all the time from listeners who've gone from thinking about writing a book to starting to write a book to having their very own debut author experience.
One of the things that these new authors say is that they've gone back and listened to all the episodes that cover off the various milestones. So this year we're going back too. We want to capture that first time again ourselves. We're going to follow a first-time author across the year, catching up multiple times along the way.
Our very first follower first-timer is Megan Rogers, author of The Heart is a Star. This segment of Follower First-Timer is brought to you by HarperCollins. Megan Rogers, this is our fourth catch-up. Listeners have already heard you talk about your early writing life, where you got the idea for The Heart is a Star, your writing process, how the book came to be published, editing, and things you've done in the lead-up to publication, including whether or not Goodreads is something you'll be consulting. Today, we're taking a bit of a turn. It might feel a little bit random and out of sequence, but we're going to talk about failure. It is a strange order of things to be talking about, but it comes on the back of a not so recent now Instagram post that you did relating to dance. So to ask a very leading question, is there a particular experience of failure in your life that had a big impact on you?
Yeah, it did. And it still catches my breath in my stomach, even just to think about it, honestly. But So as well as writing's always been my first love, but I also was a dancer, you know, I studied ballet when I was little and so forth, and studied ballet in a little church in Seaford. And I sometimes would drive up to the city with my mum and dad, and we would drive past the College of the Arts, and I would kind of, you know, I mean, I grew up in kind of lower socioeconomic, you know, suburban Australia, and, you know, to drive past the Victorian College of the Arts, I just used to think, wow. What if someday, you know, I would get to dance there and so forth. So even though I've always wanted to write a book, you know, dancing was something that moved me as well. And so when I was in early grade six, I was lucky enough that someone came along to our dance school quite randomly, actually. And they were a friend of a friend, and they came up to me and they said, do you want to audition for the College of the Arts, which is where, to explain for people who don't know, it's a high school, basically. It's high school for people who are musicians and dancers and so forth. So you study your craft along with doing the normal syllabus. And so I went along to this audition, and they have stages. So you pass all these dance stages, you know, you do bar work, you do centre work and on all that kind of stuff. And it is like the movies where you've got a number and they say, you know, number six, number 20, the rest of you can go, you know, and it gets smaller and smaller as you go on. And the last stage is a physical. And in those days, I don't know if they still do this, but they literally get you to strip down and they prod and poke you. You know, there's three or four people in the room.
Really?
That in itself. Yeah. Yeah. They weigh you. They get you to lay down on your back and rotate your legs. Even that was pretty traumatizing.
And how old are you? You're like 12.
10 or 11, 11, 11. So I turned 12 in September of grade six. So it was before that. So mid that year. So I was 11 years old. And then, you know, you go home and you know, I did it for the experience, but, you know, the little dance schools in Seaford, you know, that's often not where the intake comes from, you know. And I got a letter in the mail saying that I'd been accepted in this yellow envelope that I can still see with the crest on the top left-hand corner. And I ordered my maroon tracksuit that I had always seen people wear. And I went to school and I told my class, and they announced an assembly, and my grade six teacher, Mr. Johnson, put this big butcher's paper poster on the door that said College of the Arts. And I went to my little dance school, and Yvonne Ma, who was my dance teacher, who, you know, this beautiful, formidable woman, you know, to tell her that I'd gotten in was a really, really big moment. And a few weeks passed, quite a few weeks passed, and we got a phone call. And it's the only time I've ever heard my mum swear. And, yeah, I just, they said that there'd been a mistake. Sorry.
Me too.
I didn't get in. That I had the wrong hip structure, essentially, and that it had been missed. And, you know, it wasn't actually, I mean, of course that was upsetting, but it was the idea of going back and telling everyone, I think, that I was most ashamed about. And I still remember my bedroom. I had all these flowers in my bedroom. I remember going into my bedroom after Mum got the phone call and sitting with all these flowers, and I just thought, I don't deserve these flowers. And I took them out and I put them in the front lawn. And I don't think that, and then you're having to go back and tell people. And I did, I felt like the embodiment of failure. Because not only did I not get in, but I told people I did, and then I had to tell people that I didn't. And I don't think they were being cruel, but the kids at school, you know, they were like, you just made up all along, and you never really got in. And the worst thing is that, you know, even with the local state schools, you know, because I wasn't going to a private school or anything, you know, all of those, even the state school enrollments had closed and things like that, and I wasn't enrolled anywhere. And, you know, we ended up getting in somewhere, a great school I deeply love. But I think it still to this day, it has instilled within me this deep sense that I often don't belong. That there's something quite a little bit wrong with me, where people are just going to figure it out eventually, and that it can get taken away. And I have, you know, part of this process for me is really trying very, very hard not to let those anxieties get the better of the joy of this process.
You okay?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah.
It sounds like a pretty horrifically, like, difficult situation in terms of highs and lows and the publicness of those things. Because, yeah, I mean, you're very generous in saying that kids were confused and saying, well, you know, is this true?
Yeah.
But I suspect there's a lot of generosity. You're probably glossing over something there, I suspect. I don't know how generous kids are in grade six.
There were some pretty horrible words flung around. Somebody wrote some messages on the butcher's paper and,
Sounds like an event with a big echo. Are there ways that, looking back now, you look at that experience differently? I know you've said you don't want to carry it into the next phase, but
we all say that, don't we? It's easier said than done.
It totally easier said than done. Like, what would you say to your kid if? I feel like we'd better manage some of these things, perhaps, as adults.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things as parents we always do, isn't it? We go back and we think about those really poignant moments, and we just go, goodness, how would I deal with that? And, you know, I think one of the beautiful things was for me was that I heard how angry my mum was on the phone. And, you know, I think a lot of us, you know, maybe around the house, but didn't often hear our mums direct that anger out of themselves. You know, we didn't see our mums be angry, you know. Well, I mean, I didn't anyway. And I heard...
And in defence of you as well.
Yeah, I heard it, you know. And I think that really touched me. So I think all I can hope for is that I would show my kids how angry I was at that. But, you know, as a whole as well, though, you know, those things often don't get spoken about, so they just kind of get swept under the rug and you move on. Life's busy and you know. So you know, to answer the question, how do I see it differently? Look, you know, a lot of people said to me at the time, you know, things happen for a reason. And, you know, there's always silver linings. And it's not that I'm not a believer in that, because I think hindsight's a beautiful thing. And I think that there is always lessons in failure. But one of the things that I hope that I would embody with my kids, and that I look back on it now, and it's the reverse for me. I used to work with these couple of women, and we had this rule where, because there was some pretty, you know, we were going through times in our life and there was some hard things happening in people's lives, like people dying and so forth. And we had this promise where if somebody went through something, we wouldn't say any of those things. We wouldn't say, oh, things happen for a reason and pain heals with time. We would simply go, that is really fucked.
Yeah, agree. I've been in situations similar.
It's just fucked up.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're upset, and so you should be, and you feel angry, and that's it.
And there's nothing I can do.
No, and that's okay.
Yeah.
There's nothing kind of wrong with that. And I think rather than time giving me, I guess, the silver lining perspective, and I know, like, you know, I probably wouldn't have wanted to, you know, be a dancer, and I probably wouldn't have wanted that life for myself, but for me, it's just because I swept under the rug for a really long time, and I justified it, and I went, everyone makes mistakes, and you know, it was someone in the office, and I did that for years. I didn't cry. I didn't, you know, it took me actually a long time to cry about it. I just completely, from the next day, completely swept under the rug for years and years and years and years and years, and felt ashamed that I was upset by it, you know. And I think if anything, hindsight has, and having kids, you know, has allowed me to go, oh my God, like, you can cry about that. And I think maybe that is why I still get, well, not even still, but I've started to get emotional for it, because I never did back then. Mm. So, you know, I think it's interesting too, because I think one of the reasons why it took me so long to write my novel is because I had some healing to do in that area. So I went back and I ended up studying contemporary dance at Rosedon. And, you know, did a bit of that for some time. And I think there was part of me that needed to prove to myself that I could do that even for just a couple of years, that I wasn't completely broken either by it or because of it, or, you know, that, yeah, okay, I might not have the hip structure and so forth and the natural turnout for ballet, but, you know, I can dance. And And I want to prove, you know, to them and to myself that I can do it. And I think I had to almost get that out of my system before I did focus on. I mean, I was always writing. I was studying a degree in arts as well, so it's certainly not one or the other. But certainly before I wrote the novel, I needed to heal that part of me.
What a tough experience. I do have to say that everything happens for a reason thing. If you've ever heard that when you're in a tough situation that, probably didn't happen for a reason. It's unhelpful.
Yes, and I know people are just being kind.
I know.
I mean, how many times have we said to our kids,
oh, God,
you know, I know I'm being unhelpful. I know. Like, but you just, because when you see someone upset, it can be so anxiety inducing, you know, and you're just trying to talk or say something. So, like, I feel sympathetic to the people who have said that to me, because I know that I know they mean, they're not trying to say the wrong thing, but I also know that it really did prevent me for a really long time in feeling anything about it.
Hmm. So let's come back to the book. We're recording this still before it comes out.
Yeah.
How do you plan to manage the expectations that you may have on yourself or on others? And have you thought about what success will look like?
Oh, yeah. I think there's lots of different types of successes in this journey. And I think that I want to be able to acknowledge when there has been little successes so that I don't, which I did with the feelings of the College of the Arts and many things, is I move on to the next thing so quickly, right? You know, something good's happened and then I'm like, right, okay, what's next? And I want to really try to celebrate all the little successes along the way. So getting signed, you know, even though that happened a year ago, like that's not lost on me. I know that doesn't happen all the time. There was a long time I didn't think it was going to happen for me. And I don't want to lose that as part of the success, you know, like just to get signed, regardless of what happens, that is a success story. You know, that's so powerful and wonderful and life affirming and joy inducing that I don't want to brush over it too quickly and go, where's the next success? Because I think, you know, and to go back to the College of the Arts stuff, I think things like that and you know, or not, you know, I think that we can be quite success hungry if we think that we need that external validation to feel okay. And to go, oh, actually, no, there's nothing wrong with me because look, people think I'm okay. And so I'm just very aware that I need to be careful not to search for the kind of markers, you know, of success, the beacons of success for that reason. And I cannot promise that I won't.
The next hit, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
So what does success look like? So getting signed, absolutely. Having the publisher have faith in it, you know, there's a lot of things that I'm learning are markers of success that I didn't know were. And so going, that's great that they have some faith in it. They have faith in the book to some capacity. To have connection with readers, that's the dream, right? That's the goal is, you know, like I spent all my life being that person who falls down, sorry for anyone who doesn't fall down, folds down corners of books and underlines things. And if I see a few people do that, that's success. Like, oh my God, if someone is underlining things that I've written, that's the deepest, you know. No, and that doesn't have to be public. Somebody can send me a photo of that, and that to me would be deeply successful, you know. So that's a success marker. And I think also too, bringing my girls along for the journey is a success marker for me because my family and my beautiful husband and stuff like that, but particularly my girls because, you know, I'm very aware that even though I've worked mostly from home and having your mum suddenly have another life and be out on the road, and I don't want them to feel as though, you know, even though I want that for myself and I want them to see me doing that and to strive for something and all that, I don't want them to feel like it's completely separate for them. So for the book launch, you know, they got pretty dresses and I've bought Maya, my beautiful little 8-year-old, she's got a little heart stamp and Ava's got a little star stamp and they're going to sit next to me at the table. And so I'm going to sign a book. And so if you get a book signed at the launch, you get a little heart and a star, little red stamp from the girls.
They will love doing that.
Just to include them, right? Because I don't want it to be, oh, mum's at the table signing and mum's giving a talk. I want them to be embraced, you know, in the community and in the love that is felt at those moments that we all know. I want them to be embraced in the middle of that embrace. And that's terrible English, embraced in the middle of an embrace. I want them to be embraced within that community. And so that's a success marker for me, is my ability to not make it all about me and to bring them along. And I'd say the final success, two final success markers. One is it just doing well enough that I can keep writing. You know, because I love writing. If there's one thing that this has taught me, is that I love writing books. I love it. I love it with a deep need, a hunger almost. Like I'm a better self when I'm writing a book. So I want it to do well enough so that my publisher has faith in another one. That would be lovely. And my final one is just not to get too swept up in, you know, that there is that lovely quote where, you know, don't necessarily believe what people say, don't believe the good things and don't believe the bad things. So success for me is having enough gratefulness and humility in the moment to be appreciative of all the little successes and the team around me, because you know, they have worked their bums off for this book as well. To be grateful for that as a success marker, but also to and I don't know how successful, come back to me in a few episodes.
Well, we can.
I don't know how good I am going to be at this, but I'm going to really, really try to, you know, to not put too much weight on the good things or the bad things, you know, just to kind of try to traverse that middle ground where you're just trying to keep writing, trying to be as honest and vulnerable and engaged with people and generous with your time and efforts as possible.
Focus on the things you can control and not the things that you can't.
We'll see.
Watch this space.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.